You're about to listen to the Odd Job Pod, a James Bond podcast that you just can't wait to hear. After you have listened to this podcast, you must wait for the sound of my voice. I will tell you what to do. I will tell you when. I will tell you how. And after you have done what I told you, you will forget it. Forever. Forever. Forever.
Hello and welcome. This is another edition of the Odd Job Pod. Not just, though, another edition. I believe this is what people in the film industry may call a reboot of the Odd Job Pod. And there is a reason for a reboot of the Odd Job Pod, because myself and the rest of the pod has gone through somewhat of a transition. Let me bring in my fellow podders in the Odd Job Pod. Pay attention, listeners. It is Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellin. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hello, Gary. We're very well, thank you.
Yes, Gary, we're both very well, thank you.
Excellent. And we have transitioned because I am now in Australia. And as some people may have known from the end of the last podcast, and Graham and Terry aren't, I think is probably the easiest and most simplest way to describe it. But because there was obviously some doubt as to whether this would carry on, it most certainly has, but we thought, you know, we'll draw a line in the sand and we'll move on to the rebooted Odd Job Pod, which now comes to you not from a pub, but from the medium of both Skype and Graham's audio recording room in his house, which is I think, Graham, that qualifies as a reboot for you? Different production team?
Yeah, this is more like the production at this end, where what we do for the Sound of Football, which I don't know if listeners, if we've got a cross-section of listeners, I would think we probably have.
I reckon so, yeah.
So this is more like what we sound like on the Sound of Football, rather than how we sound on the Odd Job Pod usually. And also because of time zones as well, we're recording this in the morning.
Mm. So we're not drunk.
So we're not hopelessly drunk like we usually are when we're recording the Odd Job Pod.
Yeah, so some listeners, regular listeners, will be like switching off right now. Most won't, because I think drunk Terry and drunk Graham and drunk Gary, and, you know, these are the things we could lose from the pod.
So, yeah, I think it was one of those things. Yeah, that was a bit of chaff there, wasn't it? Really, on the wheat of our content.
I think also people will be able to hear us as well.
There is that. Mm. Yeah, we won't have those.
Which
those,
is about.
Yeah, those yeah. those huge engineering works at Waterloo Station.
No, that's right. Or just the lots and lots of other drunk people in the background making drunken noises.
Yes, yes, there is that. There is that. There is that. Are you talking about our wives again?
No, you are.
Ah, yes. Okay.
I am not talking about our wives.
Anyway, so this podcast isn't just about chaff and transition, although that could quite easily fill a number of Bond films. But instead, we thought we'd actually would stick on the theme of transition. And we talk about Bond transitions. And what we would talk about in here would be transitions from really how the Bond franchise has handled transitions, much like when they replace one and get another one in. And how it really shifts tonally between Bond films and really style and oeuvre and canon of Bond film, and how it changes as you move between them. So, Terry, obviously Bond was established, and you had this kind of slightly odd transition, if you will, at the start, which was moving from Fleming's book to having Sean Connery in there. And then you move from Connery from You Only Live Twice into On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And you suddenly, that's the first time this has happened in the Bond franchise. And on one hand, they just carried on like nothing had happened. But did you kind of see any kind of subtle shifts once that you had that kind of transition between Bonds? And how do you think they kind of handled that first transition?
Well, the interesting thing about that particular transition is the film On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is based upon the Fleming novel, which is one of his more celebrated books, and one of the better stories in Fleming's novels. So that certainly made a difference in terms of the transition, because the film, which was based quite closely on the book, was considerably better than You Only Live Twice. I know You Only Live Twice is a favourite amongst Bond fans, but I think a lot of Bond aficionados would recognise that Connery kind of is losing a bit of steam by that point. And so there's a certain lack of energy in the film. And I think that the On a Major Secret Service has more energy to it. Also in part because of the tremendous cast that it has. But I suppose, you know, you look to the actor, don't you, as the evidence of any kind of what you're talking about in terms of transition for James Bond. And obviously Lazenby was a very different type of actor, shall we say, to Sean Connery, arguably not an actor at all,
yeah,
as some might say. And so that made probably the biggest difference. I mean, there's that nod, there's that breaking of the fourth wall, isn't there, in the opening sequence. But in many ways, I think the attempt is to try and make it seem like you're still watching a James Bond film. So that cold open has liberal use of the James Bond theme. It has the Aston Martin. It has the build up to Bond lighting a cigarette. There's the pistol on the passenger seat. There's a lot of ticks of James Bond boxes saying you are watching a James Bond film. No, really, you are watching a James Bond film. Because it's conceivable, of course, that people would have watched, might even have watched this movie, not necessarily realising that they were going to watch George Lazenby and not Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't have internet and stuff like that. And a lot of people would have just turned up at picture houses, not really, frankly, not knowing what they're seeing.
Yeah, do you think so? Do you think,
I reckon,
do you think
so.
It was that? It was a big, big, big story. They were big events back then.
I suppose so. Yeah.
The premieres back then were quite big deals, weren't they? They were
yeah,
big gala events, weren't they?
I mean, it's my experience of people who in popular culture who there are members of the public who find themselves remarkably immune to this sort of
this
thing.
Is true, yeah.
And
probably more so back then.
And I think more so back then because there wasn't that ubiquity of information. But yeah, perhaps. They certainly did put a lot in terms of the marketing. But yeah, I think that cold open for me, Gary, is the big moment in the franchise, specifically for and because it needed to tell viewers, you know, they were still watching a James Bond film and to expect the same hijinks from any other James Bond film.
Mm.
And Graham as well, I guess I was going to say one thing that really is kind of probably almost overlooked a little bit now because we're so used to Bonds like changing relatively regularly, and it's almost like it's not just the next it's not about the next Bond film, it's like how many more Bond films has he got in him. But at the time, they were taking a huge risk, weren't they? Because, you know, you've obviously got Connery, who really established in there, obviously getting a little bit fed up with it and a little bit, you know, starting to pick up the telephone a little bit in the last film. But then, you know, it's still a huge risk for the Bond franchise. And from what Terry said, you kind of think there was a little bit in there as well of kind of how far do we stretch this and how safe do we play it with On a Majesty's Secret Service?
Yeah, I think it's you've got to look at the fact that Bond was still a fledgling franchise at the time. And although Connery had made a few films, it's not as if it was the first franchise film. There were others, and there are other examples of where they've changed the main character after a couple of films or three or four films in, and they put another one in. So it's not as if Bond broke the mould there. But I do think that it was obviously something that was going to guarantee the longevity of the Eon franchise anyway. To say, right, okay, well we've got all the books, we're going to hold on to them. Let's keep on doing this, and it's the reason why it's lasted for so long, because they managed to do these transitions quite well. All right, for On a Major Secret Service, there was no end of problems with the fact that they chose Lazenby. Now, I don't think Lazenby was a bad choice. I mean, he does perfectly well in that film.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, I would say that he is probably the weakest thing in that film, because in all other measures, it's an extremely strong Bond film.
Yeah.
But there is that sort of weird period where he's overdubbed by someone else.
Yes.
which sort of adds to it, it sort of adds a little bit for me, the sort of lack of trust that the producers had in him.
Mm, or the lack of range that the actor had.
Yes, yeah.
He couldn't adopt an alternative persona.
Yeah. I think when you look at the first film, when you look at Dr. No and the way they introduce him for the first time and they say, right, okay, you know, this is someone you're very familiar with in the books, and this is always a problem you have when you introduce someone from a very, very, very popular run of books, is that people have got in their own mind who they think the main characters
yeah,
are.
Yeah, of course, because that's the hardest transition of them all, isn't it?
To
go from people's imaginations onto the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, people do, and this is not a Bond thing, any adaptation of famous books,
yeah,
and you will have people grumpy going, oh, no, he's not really, that's not how it is. I'm sure that was the case with things like Harry Potter and stuff like that.
Sure.
And, you know.
Well, Fleming himself had a problem with the fact that Connery was Scottish.
Yes. Yes, although, and working class.
Yes. Yeah, well, because he's a frightful snob.
Horrific snob, yeah.
Yeah. So you've got those problems there immediately. But then for Fleming, it works so well that he actually feeds in some Scottish roots and backgrounds to Bond, which I think was great. The fact that, like, a book has actually seen films while he's still writing books and actually works it into the backstory.
And obviously you couldn't quite do that. I mean, Lazenby couldn't really detect too much of the Australian accent in there, but you couldn't really suddenly give James Bond an Australian heritage in there either.
I don't know, you could have his great great grandfather stealing a pig or something. Come on, Gary, you must come up with gags like that every week. Come on.
It's more something to do with sheep rustling for me, given that my background's Welsh. And I've moved to Australia as well. Anyway, so you've got this kind of, I find it really fascinating around the time of Honor Manstreet's Secret Service, because obviously you've got that point where they've decided that they need to move the franchise on, and the lead actor is a little bit getting a little bit fed up, and all of a sudden you've obviously got everything that went on with Lazenby, and all of a sudden you've got Connery back in a film which he really, if he just was starting to pick up the telephone and considering what number he had to dial in his performance in You Only Live Twice, he absolutely picks up the phone and decides to dial it in for Diamonds Are Forever. And one of the things, I don't know if you kind of agree with me on this one, but Honor Manstreet's Secret Service just seemed to have gone a little bit sort of ludicrously daft in places, but it almost felt like tonally it was just trying to rein in some of the excesses that were starting to creep in You Only Live Twice. And then when you get to Diamonds Are Forever, it's almost as if, for me, tonally, like Honor Manstreet's Secret Service never happened at all. And if anything, it's gone a little bit further down that route of let's give them more ridiculousness.
Yeah, Diamonds Are Forever is the classic anthology movie. It exists completely out of time. I mean, I'm sceptical about using terms like canon when it comes to James Bond films, because for me, up until the Daniel Craig films, they were all essentially anthology movies that pretty much went back to the beginning at the time. Same characters, but essentially the stories were self-contained and didn't really bear a great deal of relation to any of the previous stories. But Diamonds Are Forever really illustrates this to the nth degree, to the extent that the guy who murders James Bond's wife is done away with in the pre-credit sequence of Diamonds Are Forever in the most cartoonish and madcap and, you know, non-Bondian way imaginable. Or at least we are led to believe that he is anyway. And it's an entirely inappropriate way to carry on from what was a really, really good film. And you'd have to say that the filmmakers just decided, the Broccolis obviously felt, well, you know, let's just do a James Bond film.
Yeah.
And then, you know, worry about that. Because I think there have been plans to continue on after Honor Manstreet's Secret Service with Lazenby and continue on afterwards. So have a set up a kind of revenge story. I think that was the plan. But then when the whole thing with Lazenby fell apart and they just got Sean in to do a kind of a one-off before Roger was available, then that pretty much went out of the window. So they just kind of made this rather madcap, for me, very, very poorly put together James Bond film, even by James Bond standards.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, you start to see the sort of fledgling camp Bond era within Diamonds Are Forever. Well, you've got, let's face it, you've got Blofeld and Drag.
Yeah.
And you've got the hilarious poofters, and I use the term in keeping with the way in which they were presented.
In context, yes, yeah.
And it is very much this, welcome to the 70s, everyone.
Yeah. It's terrible, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's got its redeeming characteristics, as all James Bond films do. But, I mean, for me at the moment, the only thing that leaps to mind is the, well, is the fight in the lift in Amsterdam between Bond and Peter Franks.
Yeah.
And I think that might be it.
Yeah.
And Jill St. John, who's fantastic, beautiful and a wonderful actress and pulls that role off with panache, despite the fact that it's a, you know, pretty ghastly film that she in.
Yeah, I mean, she actually wanders around in a bikini, and you sort of think, yeah, actually, yeah, that actually makes sense.
No, it's totally, totally justifiable. Yeah, it's all in the best possible taste. And, of course, Charles Gray, who's brilliant.
Yeah,
I mean,
the returning Charles Gray.
Yeah.
Obviously, coming as another character,
as a different
character, which is brilliant for canon as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I mean, yeah, and I think you could make an argument that that Diamonds Are Forever is non-canon Bond almost as much as Never Say Never Again is.
Yeah, it definitely feels out of time. Although I'm mildly surprised that both of you there by saying of the few redeeming features of degenerated Klaus Hergesheimer's role in the James Bond.
We've completely ignored an Odd Job Pod meme. That's because it's a reboot, Gary. Sorry. Yeah, that's been kicked out, mate. It's
gone.
We
have to start these memes right again now.
can't carry over memes from previous pods. Sorry, mate.
Yeah, we need a new Klaus Hergesheimer.
Yeah, and he's blonde. We need a new blonde. Just to outrage
Hergesheimer is not blonde.
Hergesheimer is not blonde.com. Yeah, I'm going to register that tomorrow.
Yeah, if it's free.
Register to a G. Andrews of Sydney, Australia. That's what he's doing now. Yeah. That tapping you can hear is Gary. Congratulations. Hergesheimer is not blonde. .com is free. Let's buy it.
I have to get the .net.
Anyway.
Depends whether it's register.com or .com.au, because if I've done it in a hurry. Anyway, when you look at those three films, or even four films if you want, from You Only Live Twice through to On Her Majesty's Secret Service, then you've got Diamonds Are Forever, then you've got Live and Let Die. Actually, I think probably when you look at Bond as a whole, those are four movies where you've got transition between one and then obviously back to Connery again, and we've said how much out of time Diamonds Are Forever are. But those are four movies which are, with the perhaps exception of Diamonds Are Forever and You Only Live Twice, I think quite different types of film, and it's probably one of the few points in the Bond canon where you whole Bond sort of series where you do have this kind of unusualness that you've got a lot of quite different things going on in four different films before you then settle back into the Roger era.
Yeah, no, there is a very unstable period for the Bond franchise, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, certainly.
And I mean, that also perhaps explains why there was some reticence to let Roger go, because maybe they were mindful of the fact that, you know, you don't want to risk going through these kind of difficult transitions, you know, periodically. Otherwise, you could end up ruining or killing the franchise. Because by the time you get to the mid-80s, now Roger's just come out of Octopussy, there's Never Say Never Again going on, and there's a degree of uncertainty about the future of the franchise that you could understand why they would think, well, let's just keep Roger on for another one while we just think about what to do next. And mindful of the fact that you had four movies with changing Bonds, transitioning Bonds, shall we say.
But that said, the ones with the new Bonds in them are far, far better than the ones with the old Bond in that period.
Would you mean so On a Magic Secret Service is better and Live and Let Die?
Yeah.
Better, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Though they do seem to be invigorated when they make a deliberate decision to change to a new Bond, they do seem to have acquired some energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Only If Twice was the last Connery Bond. He was a bit tired. Only Magic Secret Service is really good. Diamonds Are Forever was like, oops.
Yeah.
And then Live and Let Die, it goes off into a... does go off into a different area, largely because they decide to copy the blaxploitation movies that were going on around the time. That gives the film some additional energy. And, of course, Roger is Roger, and new to the role, and he's been gagging for that role for years.
Yeah.
And he's loving it.
Yeah.
And everybody seems to be loving it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is that so because I know we'll get on to him later, but obviously when Brosnan took over, and obviously a lot of the time that Moore was going through his last few films, it really was a waiting for Pierce, wasn't it? Era for
yeah, the franchise. Although, of course, we didn't get Pierce, did we? We got Tim. But, yes. But because it's the same situation. Guys in contract with TV companies to an extent. Although, I'm puzzled about that. If Roger was under contract with The Saint, didn't Roger kind of own The Saint? So,
yeah, I know.
I suppose he had a contract and a deal done. Yeah. That was it, yeah. There's not much that you can do about that, is there, really? Yeah. Even if you did
It wasn't it the Persuaders as well, though, wasn't it?
Oh, could have been that as well.
Yeah.
Gary, do you know what the story was with Rogers? Or do we just assume
his
numerous commitments?
I always thought it was through The Saint. Yeah, that's always what I'd kind of had in my mind, that it was The Saint that was the cause of the problem. And you never know, there might have been something TV network sort of commitment, even if he did own it, that there was some kind of clause in there that we don't quite know about.
And if he'd have to pay out any money, Roger would not have done that.
No, Roger was not the kind of guy who just wrote checks.
No, he knew the value of a farthing.
Well, I mean, he did. He was born without any. So yeah.
Yes.
One thing that I was going to say that I find really interesting when you were talking, certainly in the transition to the Moore era, which set itself out. I think for me, there's two things. One, it really set itself out as quite different to anything that we'd seen before. And that was partly because there was that tapping into the blaxploitation trend, which obviously Bond is very au fait with doing when it wants to and sort of stealing from other areas. But then you've also got that point where you start looking at the films that just follow. And it does feel like there was a bit of a thought and a bit of a plan as to where they wanted to go with Roger, because whilst to me Live and Let Die stands out as being a very unusual film in the whole of the Bond series, partly because of the blaxploitation thing, you've then got follow it up with the Man with the Golden Gun, which again feels like a fairly logical move, and actually it starts properly transitioning you into full Moore era.
Full Moore. The full Roger.
You've got the full Moore, and even by the time you get to the end of A View to a Kill, actually you can kind of trace where they go quite easily, even if the films and the style of the franchise has evolved. It's not like you're leaping around quite differently. There feels like consistency, even when you've got a film which is as unusual in the Bond series as Live and Let Die.
Yeah, the couple of things to pick up there. I think the genesis of the full Roger is definitely Man with the Golden Gun.
Yes.
I think that tonally that movie is very different to Live and Let Die. Bearing in mind, Live and Let Die also has the George Martin soundtrack, which is very different to the kind of standard Jordan Barry stuff. But by the time John Barry comes back in to do Man with the Golden Gun, after a one film absence, he has changed.
Yes.
His musical style has gone through a transition, interestingly. There's a lot more strings involved. I think he makes much more use of the orchestra. He's growing as a composer. There's not as much of the bum, 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 going on in the Man with the Golden Gun. There's still some, but it's phasing out, and it's moving into... He has a break for Spy Who Loved Me, then he's back in Moonraker. And by the time we were in Moonraker, he's out of Africa, John Barry. He's Oscar winner, John Barry. And he's using, a much, much broader range within his orchestra. And it's approaching peak Barry for many people. Mm. Not for everyone, obviously, because if you're a big fan of 60s Barry, then you wasn't. But
you've got peak Barry hitting full Roger.
Peak Barry and full Roger. that's actually occurring in Moonraker. Moonraker is probably peak, arguably. Well, actually, no, maybe not. Maybe sort of like a few years after. What was it, Moonraker? Octopussy is probably as close to peak Barry.
Yeah.
But, it's not full Roger for me. Full Roger is Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
That's peak Roger Moore. That's arguably peak James Bond, actually.
Yeah, but so the overlap is really Moonraker, isn't it, there?
Yeah, I think.
I think you're right. This is why it's such a good film.
Yes, which is why it's such a good film.
Yeah. Yeah. Irrespective of the nonsense in it.
Yes.
Because there is
quite a lot of nonsense in there. I mean, for me, Bond movies have to keep you just on that right side of total and utter nonsense. Mm. And I think the truth is that Moonraker, I think, just crosses over that line from time to time.
I think
it's still a thoroughly enjoyable movie.
I think you've touched on something with Man with the Golden Gun, though, is the fact that the transition films, it's the second ones that are usually problematic. Difficult second ones, because they're usually rushed out so quickly after the first one. Now, a lot of the time, it is because there's been a gap of Bond films because in the franchise because of legal disputes, mm-hmm. studios going bust,
choosing actors, getting actors out of contracts.
Yeah, yeah. So there has always been this feeling that you've got to get another one out really quickly, and this happened even as recently as Daniel Craig, didn't it?
Yes, Quantum of Solace. Yeah. One could argue is a rushed movie.
It is a rushed movie, and the same thing happened with Pierce as well. Straight after GoldenEye, they just rushed out the next one as well. And
yes,
yeah.
Although I like Tomorrow Never Dies in films,
but it is rushed, and you know the paint's still wet on that film when you see it. It was. Hideously rushed, and it's a reason why it's flawed in certain respects.
Yeah,
there is a good Bond film in that. This isn't like The World Is Not Enough, where we thought it was good and we watched it and it was absolutely hopeless.
No, I don't remember that at all.
No,
remember we've rebooted.
We've rebooted, of course.
So
no, God, so do we have to watch it again?
No.
God, no.
No, we totally don't have to watch it again.
Well, there's actually probably one actor that if we perhaps put Connery to one side because the franchise was establishing itself, actually, I think the one actor that doesn't suffer from that particularly is Dalton, because I think both Living Daylights and License to Kill are absolutely cracking films, both of which, and obviously they're in a very kind of different era, and they also exist in a very strange place, because one, tonally, they are utterly different. You know, reboot wasn't necessarily a massive thing back at the point where you had the Living Daylights came out, but the producers had absolutely 100% said, we are going to reboot Bond at this stage, and Timothy Dalton's everything that Roger Moore isn't, very, very different in kind of tone, style, feel. Obviously, you had a lot of the Lethal Weapon films, which really came to the fore in License to Kill, which could have quite easily potentially been a Lethal Weapon style film. But then you've also got the fact that neither of both of them feel very well-rounded films. Both of them stand apart from each other, and both of them, I think, are almost a little bit like Live and Let Die. You could pluck them out of the Bond world and probably call them another film, and they would have still felt very much right of the era that they were in. Whereas a lot of the other films could only be Bond films. And I think Dalton's one's really interesting. And you know, to the original point, I think, you know, it's one of the few, you know, it's probably the only actor in the franchise where that second film hasn't been problematic, because if anything, I think License to Kill is it's problematic in some ways, but also it's a really, really good watch. And it's one of those films that if ever I see License to Kill on TV, I know I'm just in for a great couple of hours.
Certainly. As you say, it really taps into the mood of the moment, a lot like Live and Let Die.
Mm.
It is very reminiscent of films that are out at the time, and much in the same way that Daniel Craig has the Bourne films to lean on a bit for his reinterpretation of the role. Then Dalton has got this other action moves, although he's not really cut from the same cloth as most of the other action film stars of the time.
No, I mean he's not a. I mean it's an interesting. He was an interesting choice because he was very much in the tradition of picking not unknowns but picking actors who are not, you know, A-list superstars.
Yeah. Well, considering as well that Gibson was on the favourite list for a long time.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For being a Bond, wasn't he?
Yeah,
definitely.
I mean, I think that there would have been a time in his career when I think that would have been quite watchable. I would have quite enjoyed Mel Gibson. I mean, you know, in that period, sort of like that, sort of just after Mad Max, when he did films like You're Living Dangerously and that, which are great films.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could see there's scenes in that where he's where he's all sort of like scrubbed up, and he looks amazing. He looks great, and he looks for all the world like a, like James Bond. I remember watching that movie with my cousin, who's a big Bond fan, and we watched it. And there's this thing where he walks into this function, and he's got his dicky bow on, and he goes there, and my cousin just goes, "My name's Bond," and you just you could easily have just said that. And I thought, that would have been really good. Mm. They went for Tim because I guess they go for a British guy, and I guess that they also follow that tradition of not picking, you know, big stars. Roger was a big star in television, but that is not the same thing. Back in the 1960s and 70s, that was not the same thing. Television was really low rent. Tim, more famous for his stage career and the occasional role in films, particularly, of course, not forgetting Flash Gordon, one of the best films ever made.
Yes.
Without doubt. He tried to sort of like bottle some of that Fleming sort of like savagery. I think that he was clearly a big fan of that, but I'm not entirely certain whether that actually suited him as an actor. I'm not sure he's brutal enough. And I don't think he conveyed that brutality. He just got a bit angry. And I'm not sure whether or not another actor might have done that better. He actually might have been better off, you know, being a little bit more of the suave public schoolboy.
Yeah, I wonder, though, if because he followed Moore, he couldn't do that.
No, he couldn't.
Backed in a corner.
That's
really,
right.
As far as that's concerned.
At the time, I loved those movies, and I loved Tim doing that. But on reflection, I wonder whether or not that was really the right thing for him. I mean, that was such a breath of fresh air, The Living Daylights, when it came out. And I know this it's heresy to say it, but at the time, I was a teenager, and I went to see A View to a Kill, I don't know, the requisite three times that teenage Bond fans do. At the cinema, and then watched it, you know, again after having, you know, copied it from the video store over and over again. I was weary of Roger Moore and really wanted to change in the franchise. It's a horrible thing to say now, but it's true. At the time, that was true. When Tim came along, he was so different.
Yeah,
I was delighted with Living Daylights when it came out.
View to a Kill is an uneasy watch in places because Roger is an old fella there.
Yeah, it's old fella, and he looks a bit creepy. He's cavorting with these really young women, and it looks creepy and wrong.
He does look very, 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 very creepy.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, and especially when he's, like, going around with his mate, you know, Patrick McNee. You know, two old fellas on the pole. Well,
I must confess, I really enjoy those scenes, though, because, I mean, Patrick McNee in a Bond film is a bit of a wet dream for Bond fans of a certain vintage because of his connections with the Avengers. Because the Avengers has a lot to thank James Bond for.
Yes. Yeah.
And the character of Steed, played by Patrick McNee, has a lot to thank James Bond for. And maybe vice versa as well.
Yeah.
So it was really nice when they did that. We're off topic, I know, but it was really nice when they had those little scenes.
Yeah, I mean it's. I think there's, for me, when you look between the two films, and I don't think you could get two more different films in transition than A View to a Kill through into The Living Daylights. Graham, would you kind of almost say that the producers of Living Daylights and Dalton almost in essence probably had one thing that, which again, I don't think many other Bonds had, which was almost a blank slate, because it was quite clear that when you got to the end of the Moore era, that you couldn't, you know, there wasn't really much more you could do on that unless you wanted to completely replicate it and get a young Moore in. And the minute you've decided to get somebody like Dalton in, who is not anything like Roger Moore, you're almost giving yourself a little bit of a blank canvas to work with at that stage.
Yeah.
You've still got to make a Bond film.
You still have to make a Bond film.
You've still got to make a Bond film, but you've got a kind of Bond film, but without too much of what's expected, and you can go a little bit differently, and you can return it to some of its era as a spy film, because I think Living Daylights is a fantastic spy film, not just a kind of Bond film. It's a spy film, which hadn't been done for quite a while in the Bond franchise.
The beauty of the Bond, though, is that it all overlaps, and so you've got Q going across five Bonds?
Yes, well, all the way up to Pierce, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you've got M going up to, well, Bernard Lee going up to Moonraker.
Yeah.
And you've got Moneypenny, obviously, and you've got Judi Dench's M going between Pierce Brosnan and going into the reboot as well.
Yes, yeah.
Which is very interesting because because her character changes completely. It comes around completely.
Well, I mean, that's the precedent that we use to keep Gary.
Yes.
For our reboot.
Yeah, you are Judi Dench now, Gary, you know that.
Suddenly I'll be turning around on this podcast and saying, you know what, I really, really like Moonraker.
So to answer your question, I think looking at the whole fact that it does give you a clean slate, yes it does, but you've obviously got to bring everything else along with it. So I think like when you've got George Martin's soundtrack, Marvin Hamlisch's soundtrack for Spy Love Me, and they are so bang on modern soundtracks for the time, and yet also bringing everything that has gone on before as well.
Mm. And of course, Bill Conti's soundtrack, which mustn't be forgotten.
Yes,
because in our new rebooted universe, that's one of the best soundtracks there ever was.
Yeah, and you see, like transitions aren't that easy. So we found our own transition.
No, I've gone full revision on Bill Conti's Fior Eyes Own. I love that. I'm serious. I love that score. Now I loathed it at the time.
Yes,
you've
completely retconned it now.
I have indeed. Yeah. It's a wonderful pastiche of contemporary disco music.
Reclaiming the Conti.
Reclaim the Conti, indeed. Yeah. And Sheena Easton, while we're at it. No, let's not go that far.
This is where I've kind of always thought Dalton kind of stands as a very kind of curious point, because again, you've got a four Bond transitional bit with two films with the same actor in, which you didn't have back in that kind of four film era, Connery, Moore, Lazenby, where they hop between different actors and different styles. At least there's a tone, very tonal similarity between The Living Daylights and License to Kill. And then you have Goldeneye, which has obviously been quite a long break in there. And Graham, again, I talked to you when I kind of said, well, you've got a bit of a clean slate there. You've got a kind of odd situation in that it has been so long since you've had your last Bond film that you're almost bringing in a new audience back to Bond, yet you can't make it too different. So you've got almost a very different type of canvas that you're working with there.
Well, certainly. And I think the makers, the producers of the film are more than aware of that. And there is a scene in there, as we've already mentioned, about the new M. And how her character is and what she thinks of Bond, because what she's saying is what a lot of people are saying outside in society about, like, well, why on earth are they making another Bond film? This man is completely out of touch with, you know, the 90s. You can't just get away with what you've got away with before.
For millennials listening to this. Millennials listening to this.
Yeah, that's funny.
For millennials, that is funny. That's the funniest thing I think I've ever said.
Certainly on the rebooted podcast.
In the 90s, we all thought the world was going to be a better place. We genuinely actually thought that. We thought we got our heads around global warming. The Cold War was over. And we felt that things were going to get better. It's true. It's hard to believe, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And yet, GoldenEye, I think, to an extent, addresses this. He said, well, you don't need Bond anymore.
Yeah.
And the sexism, the misogyny, the womanising, and these aspects of the character that had developed critics and over the years, and for good cause as well, in fairness. And in many ways, GoldenEye was an attempt to escape from the Bond legacy while at the same time still being Bond and still obviously cashing in on all that lovely Bond money that it makes.
Yeah.
I mean, the Eric Serra soundtrack. I keep going back to soundtracks. I wonder why.
Yeah.
I keep going back to that was perhaps too much of a departure, but that the intention was, again, a contemporary composer who did a shot to fame to an extent for his scoring of the film Leon, wonderful, marvellous Jean Reno movie. Ushering in a new era of Bond, a new, shall I say, postmodern era of the Bond franchise, The reference to the Lienz Cossacks as well is another in that movie, is another sort of like a attempt to say, look, we're moving this character on. So when you've got, like, for example, an Emergency Secret Service, which is saying to its audience, this is still James Bond. Look, there's even the James Bond music going on in the background, you know. To GoldenEye, where you've got, this is not James Bond.
Yeah.
Or at least it's a different James Bond. This is a James Bond you're going to like.
Yeah.
And I think by and large it succeeds
for that
movie.
This is a James Bond who's quite self-aware of what you think of him. he knows that, you know, okay, it's problematic. But I think it is interesting about how this is, what, 20 years ago?
Yes.
20 years ago.
And
you can see how Bond has been able to reinvent himself.
Mm.
A lot of the flaws are still there, but then again, a lot of the flaws are still there in society. So maybe it's a reflection.
Yes. And I think as well, one of the things that, you know, on GoldenEye, especially when you kind of look at it, it does something that you've obviously mentioned with M, but and the Cossack reference as well. But also, there's the first time, I think it's the first time I can remember in a Bond film, where you have, and it's obviously quite smart having Trevelyan as the kind of main baddie, which is just basically like, for Queen and Country, you don't really believe that anymore. What's the point? Which, for Bond, actually is, whilst GoldenEye is a very kind of watchable Bond, very enjoyable Bond, and ticks all the sort of Bond by numbers that you'd need for any good Bond, it does do a lot of basically, you know, not just pointing out Bond's flaws, but the very notion of Bond through sort of how Trevelyan sort of tries to contrast himself with Bond, I think is really fascinating, and kind of, you've got that element of double cross, which has certainly sort of come in the Dalton films, but you've never really had anybody explicitly call out, what's the point of James Bond in a film? That just didn't happen.
And Trevelyan does that. Mm. So Trevelyan exists as that, as this is Bond killing Bond, to speak. Oh, new Bond killing old Bond and moving on. But actually what happened was he just got the same old Bond.
Pretty much, yeah. And within a few films, his car was turning invisible.
Indeed. Yes. Yes, that's really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is the point we're reaching, isn't it? They put a lot of work into the transitions, but
they
don't follow through. They don't stick with it.
No, but again, I mean, I go back to this, up until DC, this is a franchise that doesn't serialise.
No.
There's no, you know, fascinating character arcs going on. I for one, you know, becoming lost nostalgic. I think I've mentioned to you recently, I'm becoming weary of serialised drama. And I'm wondering at one point in the future whether or not, you know, mass audiences will start to become weary of serialised drama. And one of the reasons is Spectre, which is just completely retconning, you know, the previous three movies to try and turn it all into something that was always Blofeld all along.
Yeah.
Which is just a scarcely believable. I mean, there was nothing foreshadowing that in the previous movies, and you know, we watched those movies. I mean, we're not idiots. You know, that's clearly not how it worked. And it really, for me, blew a big hole in that movie, which I think is a way too long movie anyway. And I think the Bond suits itself well to individual one-off stories. Bond gets given a mission. Bond completes the mission.
Yeah,
and I would like that to happen.
Promise made at the end of Skyfall, wasn't it? And
yes,
we all went yes, great, okay.
Great. Here we go. Yeah. Here is he's got his padded office. M is back in his office.
Yeah,
and there is Bond standing. Then M sat behind his desk, hands him a file, ready to get to work. 007.
Yeah.
Let's go and do another retrospective story about my past.
No, yeah, let's remake Quantum of Solace.
Yes, what a terrible idea. And I fear that this will happen with the next movie as well. What I'm hoping for the next movie is just a big goodbye for Daniel Craig, who's been a fine Bond. Here we go, Bond, some person wants to blow up the world. Go out there and stop him, will you? And off he goes and does it.
Yes.
A good standalone film. How much do you reckon? Because we've talked about this a lot on, well, we've talked about a lot on this podcast. We've talked about it in previous podcasts, which have not been in part of this reboot. but we've talked a lot about kind of, you know, the idea of kind of Live and Let Die being influenced by blaxploitation, which was obviously very big at the time. You know, talked about Dalton being influenced by the kind of Lethal Weapon style films. And when we talk about the kind of those huge story arcs, obviously you look at what's one of the biggest things in cinema at the moment, it's the Marvel Universe, which, if you're talking story arcs, are kind of absolutely huge to keep up with. Do you think there's kind of a bit of that playing on the kind of producers' minds when you started moving forward? And obviously Craig transitioned with a brilliant Casino Royale, which was works as a standalone film. And then as you move further through, there's a sudden kind of thought of, well, the biggest film franchises in the world at the moment are doing this huge, complicated canon, everything connected to everything else. And that appears to be in vogue at the moment.
Yeah, the extended universe, the James Bond extended universe has been discussed.
Yeah.
It is a matter of fairly intense media speculation that when the distribution rights for Bond come up, and the talk also is of Barbara and Michael G. Wilson turning in and retiring and selling Eon to someone else.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there could be a big change, and it might well be the new owners might want to then go down the road of a James Bond extended universe. And there's enough talk about it in the media to suggest that it's perhaps being seriously considered.
Well, I think you've only got to look at Star Wars.
Yeah.
And look at what Disney are doing with it now.
Yeah.
And taking it, and, you know, they've already gone through the sort of that animated series, which are hugely popular.
Yeah.
And now they've got offshoot films coming off there.
Rogue One and Han Solo coming out as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, first offshoot film since Caravan of Courage.
Since Caravan of Courage, big deal, big deal.
big deal.
Again,
how do you follow that?
With Rogue One is how you follow it. That's how you follow it. That's what that's what was required.
Yeah, these things are never easy, are they?
No. They're always problematic. But we had in a previous
thing?
Incarnation of our of Odra, we had a Bond spin-offs. Which, if I'd thought it through, I would have called it the James Bond Extended Universe as a podcast title. But that's effectively what we were talking about. Would think it's a good thing, because we thought all of the ideas that we had were great ideas, mine.
But of course, because we're rebooting, we could have the whole conversation again, can't we?
We can. We've got to rego. So we'll
that's
do that.
The beauty of rebooting,
yes,
isn't it?
We'll revisit this topic and have a conversation about the James Bond Extended Universe. But to answer your question, Gary, I think, as I have just said, I'm weary of serialisation. But that being said, I have no problem with doing stories about James Bond characters elsewhere. But what I'm bored of is story arcs.
Yeah,
frankly,
I think there is another problem here. Is that when you're saying with the fact that the Marvel Cinematic Universe, compare that to the DC Cinematic Universe, and you've got different strands of the same characters going off in different directions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a DC Cinematic Universe, and then there's the television universe as well.
Yeah.
Very soon we're going to have a Flash movie and a Flash TV series. They obviously feel that the audience is mature enough to be able to cope with these things.
Well, I think of the Sherlock Holmes franchises now out at the moment, which obviously, you know, the you've got the BBC.
Yes,
series.
And then of course you've got Elementary as well.
You've got Elementary, and I suppose as well you've got the Guy Ritchie films as well.
Yes, you could. Are they still? They're not really going anymore.
They're not really going, but
there was
more than one film, so
you
could call it a franchise.
I'm cracking those movies.
But all three very, very different.
Yeah.
Different beasts, aren't they?
Yeah.
So and tackle it in a different way. Two of them are obviously serial TV. Because they rely, especially the BBC one, relies heavily on things that have gone on in previous episodes.
Mm.
I'm with you, Terry. I think it holds it back.
Mm.
Every time it just you just give the character something to carry. He's just got baggage. And he's not even got baggage on wheels. He's having to carry that.
He's carrying it on his shoulders. He's becoming a mule. For his own narrative.
Yeah, and I think that's what Bond is in danger of. If you keep on doing this, you're just doing it like, as we mentioned, the aforementioned Rogue One. you know, just there just to tick the boxes of knowledgeable fans.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've said, I don't know whether we've ever committed this to digital, but I mean, I think it is worth saying Rogue One is an extremely expensive, well-made fan film.
Yeah.
And if you've ever watched fan fiction, you'll know what I mean. And for that, it's very enjoyable because I'm a Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
But I don't know what intrinsic value it has beyond pleasing Star Wars fans and beyond making lots and lots of money. You know, I'm not quite sure whether or not it's terribly, you know, worthy in any other respect.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't like that to happen to James Bond.
No, I think as well it adds other elements to it. Because before we move on to another subject, I think we saw it a bit in Inspector, where you've now got this sort of Bond Scooby gang thing running around
the
at Bond the
ensemble.
So making
the Bond mystery machine.
Yeah, exactly. You've got this.
When you bring in good actors with reputations and ambitions and careers.
Yeah.
You know, you bring in people like Naomi. You bring in people like Ben. You know, they are on an upward trajectory and, they're expected to do things.
Yeah, they're not just exposition, are they?
I think Rafe is probably at a point where he might be willing to say, I'll be the Bernard Lee guy. Mm. I'll just come in, do a couple of scenes, collect my check, and then go on to my next project.
Yeah.
I think Bernard Lee just basically, Bond was something that he did in order to supplement his pension.
He does steal quite a lot of scenes that he's in, though, doesn't he?
Bernard Lee?
No, Rafe.
Well, he is brilliant. But you can understand when you've got all that talent, why and Rory Kinnear as well, why you would want to use it and utilise it.
Yeah.
But is that really what makes, are these the best ingredients for a really good James Bond film? I think that's the question you need to ask.
So, is it Gary?
No. I really, really loved Skyfall, but Spectre, same as you, I thought it got to a point where it just got a bit bloated and a bit kind of weighted down by trying to justify itself when it didn't actually need to justify anything. So I would completely concur with what you said. And I also think it raises for me something really interesting that we kind of didn't know whether we assumed there wouldn't have been another Craig film given the ending on the last one, but we know that there's going to be a fifth one now. It still raises a really interesting question of how do they transition from Craig, because when you look back at all the other Bond transitions, you have something incredibly different that's brought by a different actor, with perhaps only the Lazenby transition being the least standout of kind of difference between what precedes it and what follows it. Whereas you've now got this kind of whole universe established. And that transition for me is fascinating. Are they going to go, when it eventually happens, are they going to kind of reboot again and ignore what's happened in the past? Probably not too dissimilar to what Spider-Man's done several times on the big screen. Or are they going to try and continue what you've got? Or are they going to try and go for a bit of a halfway house, sort of a little bit like we had between Brosnan and Craig and Judi Dench being that kind of link between the two? How are they going to handle it?
I know what I'd do.
What would you do?
Well, if I was it, I would arrive upon a central cast of characters, get the new Bond, sign them up to a multi-movie deal, either and retain or recast the supporting characters depending on the actors and what they want to do and that. And then I would bring in different directors. The franchise is so strong now, and that there are extremely, so strong, so well established, that there are extremely talented directors out there who know what a James Bond film is and would know how to make one, but would still have their own idea about what would be, and you give them one movie to do it. So give Tarantino a Bond movie. One. Give Nolan a Bond movie. One, though. You'll only get one movie, mate. And you have to put in all of that into that, and then you go from there. And then that way, you're probably the best guarantee of getting a consistently good James Bond films, because you're getting in. Keep the production team around them the same. Yeah, keep the actors the same, keep that continuity going there so we know we're watching Bond films. Bring in, you know, auteur directors to come in and make individual James Bond films, And I think that that's for me, that's the future of the franchise.
Mm. Interesting, because the four Brosnan films had four different directors.
Yes.
So do you think that was to its advantage?
I think the difference between then and what I'm arguing,
yeah,
is that the franchise was studio led rather than director led.
Right. Okay.
And I think that you, with Mendes, you have had a change in that. I think Mendes is, and indeed Craig, have had a much bigger say on the direction of the franchise. And I think that, although I don't like where they took it, I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. And I think that keeping the studio consistent, but bestowing the creative freedom upon the director and the writers to say, produce a Bond film, and then employ another guy to do the next one, and so on, or girl, I should say.
I had a very, very random thought that popped into my head when I started thinking of directors that you could possibly put in there, and my brain suddenly went, I wonder what a James Bond film directed by Luc Besson would be.
Yes, I often wonder what I think actually that would be quite watchable. I think it'd be really slick. I mean, with some fantastic action sequences in it. It also might be quite florid, and a bit, and very, very visual. Mm. I often wonder what a James Bond film directed by Wes Anderson would be like. Apart from just like a preponderance of Bill Murray. An almost sickening amount of Bill Murray in it, but I wonder.
There's a lot of whimsy in there.
Yeah, it would be a bit whimsy. I'm half joking, but I would be really. I mean, they would never take such a risk, but again, as I say, the franchise is strong. Everyone knows what a James Bond film is. Any filmmaker now, certainly in Hollywood, knows exactly what a James Bond film is, and I bet you has an opinion about how they would make a James Bond film.
I'm thinking now, Ang Lee's Hulk film.
Right. Okay.
Did you see that one?
Yeah, I did. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So that is a good counter argument to my idea. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not suggesting that my idea is
quite
problematic.
I like that film, though.
No. Yes. Yeah. It's all right. But yeah. I don't know.
It's all right.
It's all right. It's a bit Nick Nolte, isn't it?
It is very Nick Nolte in places, yes. But then again, it's a bit Jennifer Connelly as well.
Yeah, I didn't consider that.
Yes, yeah. which you know, that makes up for a hell of a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I grant you what I'm proposing is perhaps a little bit out, but I don't think it's completely out of the question. And like I said, I mean, the Hulk struggles in that there's no cinematic heritage.
No.
Whereas there's over 50 years of cinematic heritage,
sure,
for an experienced and talented director to fall back on. So again, I think the franchise is strong enough to be able to handle, you know, auteurs. John Carpenter, that's what I want to see.
John Carpenter's
James Bond.
He'd have to do a soundtrack as well.
He would. That would be amazing.
That's what you really wanted to do.
That's actually all I want. I just want John Carpenter to do a James Bond album. Maybe he should just do that without going to the trouble of making a film. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll just drop him a tweet tomorrow and say, I thought about doing that.
Do so. He'll probably reply.
He probably will, yeah.
That would be incredible. There's so many. Now you think about it, I mean, this almost feels like a podcast or pub discussion in itself, because
we've got episode two, then.
There's Nick episode done, yeah. Something for the listeners to think about as well.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it almost feels like we suddenly got ourselves an extended Odd Job Pod universe, or continuing from one to the other. But do you think we've hit a good point to kind of wrap up on transitioning Bond? From there,
indeed, I think.
I think our transition is drawing to a close.
Finally,
so at that point, I think we will, as Graham said, we will draw our transition to a close, as we've taken a whistle stop tour, jumping in and out of various Bonds. And as ever, listeners, we'd love your thoughts on which auteurs you'd like to see. If you can imagine what a Luc Besson directed Bond would be like, if you can imagine what an Ed Wood directed Bond could have been like, both would be equally fascinating. But I think reboot part one is now done. And we will retire through to quickly rush out a second film because that's what the listeners want in very quick succession, having had to wait all of a few months while I get myself settled in Australia for the Netflix Odd Job pod. But thank you very much to Graham and Terry, who've managed to get through this podcast without a beer, which is unusual for Odd Job pod. It really is.
It's unusual for any podcast for me.
No. Yeah, how's it been for you, gentlemen?
Yeah, it's been very early in the morning.
But it gives us the whole day ahead, doesn't it?
It's true. It's true. Yeah,
it does. I, on the other hand, have been drinking beer throughout, which probably may or may not show in the final edit. But thank you very much to Graham and Terry. Thank you very much, dear listener, as well for your time through Bond's transition. And please let us know of your thoughts of transitioning of your own. And the Odd Job Pod will be back for our next podcast. Thank you very much and goodbye.
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 This was such a wonderful podcast and you just can't wait for the next one. And now I want you to open Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or any other podcatching service. Find Odd Job Pod and give it a 5-star rating. Tell them it is such a wonderful podcast and you just can't wait for the next one. And after you have done what I told you, you will forget it. Forever. Forever. Forever.
And how are things your end?
Yeah, no big changes here, are there, really?
No.
No, it's all pretty much as you left it, really.
Mm. That is complete chaos and panic.
I don't know how much of the news you get or whether or not all the news of the homeland is via social media, which must be horrifying for you.
I get sort of morning updates from The Guardian and it's just kind of you're all over. And there, I work like this. Part of me, where I just look and I go, I'm glad I'm not there at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised that all the news over your end isn't actually just full of Ben Stokes all the time.
I don't know. England doesn't really get too much of a look in other than when we've done something monumentally stupid, which is tends to be relatively regularly. What is brilliant is the SBS, which is kind of like one of their worthy broadcasters over here, every morning will do like a roundup of news from around the world, and it just cuts live to news channels, so you can get news in Greek, followed by news in Spanish, followed by French news. So it's quite a brilliant sort of yeah.
It's a really good
it's
idea.
Kind of a bit like news roulette. You don't quite. If you remember chat roulette, sort of quite big in the day. It's something akin to that, but just you press SBS and you never quite know which national news you're going to get at any given point in time.
I did wonder as soon as we started Skype how long it would be before Gary mentioned chat roulette. And I didn't have 5 minutes down there. I thought we'd be 20 minutes in.
Yeah, well, it's a rollover till next time. Gary, obviously a big user of chat roulette back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah. That's why he wears glasses.
I think some of that... In fact, I believe some of his older injunctions relate to chat roulette.
See, this is what you've been missing, isn't it, Gary?